What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to Past Gas. This week, it's part two on Porsche. We're talking post-World War II restructuring, maybe Ferdinand Porsche's war crimes a little bit. We also talk about the birth of the 9/11. It's the French's fault that it's called that. Stick around so you learn what I'm talking about. This is part two of our three-part series. Let's get right into it. In the aftermath of World War II, Europe lay in ruin. Rationing went on for years, as did the cleaning of the streets and the rebuilding of cities. It was a challenging time, but the signs of a hopeful future could be found in the car industry, especially with companies like Porsche. The auto world we know today took shape in this era. People's cars like the Volkswagen Beetle, the Austin Mini, and the Fiat 500 democratized the automobile. Racing was also coming into its own, and Formula One had its debut season. Racing-inspired supercars soon followed that changed the way people thought about cars and what could be achieved with them. At the forefront of this important and influential era was Porsche. They would be one of the first companies in the post-war sports car game, stake a claim as one of the best brands in racing, and create a car that would define the sports car itself. Today on Past Gas, how did Porsche pull itself from the ashes of its World War II legacy? How did an Italian businessman accidentally bankrupt himself, saving them from disaster? And who could possibly replace Ferdinand Porsche? And how did that person develop the best sports car in the world? It's the history of Porsche, part two. Welcome back to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes, joined as always by Bart Bidlingmeyer.
It's an audio format. You got to say something.
I clicked. I did a click when I did that point.
Hi.
And Joe Weber.
Nothing goes with a donut better than a nice cup of Joe.
Oh, hey, Joe Weber.
That's pretty good.
Right?
That's pretty good. I can't believe it's taken us, 298
episodes? 298 episodes. Well, we are right good on the Lord. Brink of the 300.
I know. Wow. We're getting close. This week is part two of our three-part history on Porsche. As that intro let you know.
You said it like a question.
I did it?
Porsche?
Porsche, I think.
Oh, I got to tee you up, though. No one knows who you are.
Oh, I already introduced myself.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I'm Nolan Sykes.
You want to test out a new catchphrase, though?
Nah.
Okay.
I'm Nolan, no last name.
Sykes! Nolan. It's pretty good. Okay. Pretty good. Never thought of it that way. Damn. Should we just get into it?
Let's get into it.
Continue the story. I have a question I was thinking about this morning.
Okay.
Because I couldn't drive my A3. There's some electrical issue going on. I got to get fixed. But I drove my Beamer, which is manual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of videos you see on Instagram of like in-car driving, people do this.
Yeah.
What the hell is that shift? And why do you need to be so extra?
Joe is referring to the palm out kind of shift between third and fourth.
Thumb down, pronated arm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is so you don't accidentally shift from third to second. Because if you have it like this, like normal grip style, like it's very possible that if you're doing aggressive shifts, like you could accidentally go third downshift rather than up. Shifting upwards.
That would only protect you if you don't have a sixth gear, though, because you could get into sixth by accident, too.
But that won't blow your engine, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why people do that.
How about you just have good mechanical dexterity in your fingers?
I don't know,
How about that?
I don't know.
Yeah, but what if you're drunk?
I didn't think about if you were drunk and you're driving a race car. Yeah.
Here you go.
They used to drink during Le Mans.
Talked about that in one of the episodes. There's like a guy who won it drunk, basically.
Yeah.
Wow. Drank brandy the whole time. Yeah.
That would make me so tired. Like, why?
Oh, I know.
Well, no, but there is a level of alcohol that I think does keep you up. But I also, when I was waiting tables, I was like 18, 19 maybe. I don't know. But there was a one of the bussers was talking about like, yeah, I used to drive a truck. You get a, it's easy. You just 18 hours, you just, you leave at night, you just get yourself a bottle of bourbon.
What?
And you just go.
Damn.
And I was like, if this is a thing, I feel much less safe now.
Yeah.
If this is happening, the way you're talking about this as though it's advice, makes me feel a little less safe driving at night on the highway.
Yeah, how big is he talking about of the bottle, though? Like, is it a, one of those little ones?
Well, he was like this, but he was also like 8 feet tall. So it was probably a normal size bottle.
Like the Andre the Giant holding a beer.
Beer King,
Shall we get into this?
Yeah, thank you guys for clearing asked.
Okay.
We already said yes, Nolan. Okay.
Thank you for clearing that thumb down shift.
Mm-hmm. Try it out.
Nah, I don't want
to.
I don't.
Joe's gonna come in a sling.
Yeah.
I tried the.
It feels really weird to me. It feels like my arm is not supposed to pronate that much.
Yeah, is your ulna all f***ed up? Is that why you think?
I don't know.
Oh,
that's supination.
So this is pronation that way. Okay.
When your feet, this is you're over pronated. This is your supinated.
Okay.
I'm supinated, dude. Is that your throwing arm? Do you not want to mess
this
it up?
My throwing arm.
Well, maybe
I think
it'll
it's
help
my
your
massive muscles.
It'll help your pitch, dude.
You could get that.
Oh, see? Like yeah. What is that? You could do a circle change with that, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'll try it out.
Yeah. All you got to do to convince Joe to do something is tell him it'll improve his
baseball terms.
Baseball game. Yeah. All right. Let's get into it. So we left off in part one with the arrest of Porsche founder and namesake Ferdinand Porsche and his son Ferry. The two had been accused of war crimes by the French. More specifically, they were accused of using French slave labor and illegally exported French-made machines and tools in their factory in Germany. The case against Ferry was weaker than it was for Ferdinand, and after around 6 months in prison, he was released on bail. He immediately set about petitioning for his father's release. Given the gravity of the charges, it was a huge and complicated challenge, one that I don't really feel much empathy for as I'm reading this.
Yeah, it's what are you in for? War crimes. Oh.
Yeah.
How about you? I jaywalking?
Allegedly, French authorities had other less credible motivations to hold Ferdinand prisoner. Legend has it that like many high-profile engineers that collaborated with the Nazis, Ferdinand's specific field of expertise was useful to the Allies. In much the same way, Wernher von Braun was enlisted to build the U.S. space program. The French looked at the work Ferdinand had done on Germany's people car, the Beetle, wanted Ferdinand's help in designing a people's car of their own, and had him meet with their own engineers. Again, that's a legend or,
old wives' tale.
Oh, yeah. Another legend claims that the French...
I wish Nikki would quit telling me about how the French tried to get Porsche to make him a car. These old wives' tales.
Another legend claims that the French knew that they could simply extort the Porsche family for a large bail payment. There's little evidence that either legend is true, but we do know that Ferdinand's help building a car was sought out while he was incarcerated. Not by the French.
Incarcerated, right? Cars.
Check out our new podcast, Incarcerated, where we won't let you out of our car till you answer 10 questions and eat 10 spicy wings.
Ooh. But, so, it wasn't by the French.
That's gold, Joe.
We do know that Ferdinand's help building a car was sought out while he was incarcerated, but not by the French, but by a retired Italian soccer player. When I was in Paris, I went to the French Resistance Museum.
Mm. Oh, cool.
Which was pretty interesting. But something I feel like we don't learn about, like, in school, obviously, because it doesn't really pertain to us, but, like, Vichy France in World War II, super interesting.
That was, like, they sided with the Germans, right?
Yeah, so it was kind of like, when the Germans invaded France, a faction within the government decided that it'd be easier to just concede to the Germans and just kind of like co-govern the territory, basically. It became, wasn't like a territory. Well, Vichy France itself became like its own state, I think. It was led by like a World War One hero, French World War One hero, but didn't really work out for them. After being moved from a French military prison in occupied Germany to a medieval prison in Dijon, France, Ferdinand was visited by Italian entrepreneur Piero Duccio.
I love the idea, though, that it's a medieval prison. Like, not just that it had existed since medieval times, a great restaurant, by the way, but that it had, but like, if they moved him, they had like a medieval themed prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, you're putting you on the shackles on this brick wall.
Yeah, choose your color because you're going to be fighting the other prisoners in the yard.
After suffering a career-ending knee injury playing as a midfielder for Juventus, Duccio retired.
Juventus.
Most racist Italian football club.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. They're a pretty storied team.
Yeah.
A lot of wins, a lot of W's.
After suffering a career-ending knee injury playing for Italy's most racist team, Duccio retired from professional soccer and fell in love
with
racing.
It's their fans that are racist.
Okay. Good save.
But also their players and some of their managers.
He used his small soccer fortune to open a textile factory before the war, which provided uniforms to the Italian military. Naturally, demand for military uniforms was high during the late 30s and early 40s, and by war's end, Duccio was one of the few Europeans with any means to invest.
Wow, talk about getting in at the right time.
Yeah. Hey, I'm on this racist soccer team. I'm going to get in bed with the fascists. I'm going to make their clothes. Now I'm rich. Let's make some cars. In 1946, Duccio founded the Cisitalia Car Company with the dream of being one of the biggest names in racing and sports cars in the world. He might have had some success as a racer himself, but building a car and running a car business were two different things entirely. And for this, he turned to the Porsches. Duccio was willing to do whatever it took to get the eldest Porsche out of prison, and offered to finance the effort and to give the Porsche family a generous contract to build him a Grand Prix car, which was the predecessor series to Formula One. After the introduction with Ferdinand, a meeting was arranged between Duccio and Ferry in late 1946, and a contract was signed. With Ferdinand still behind bars and handsome sum paid to the Porsche family, Duccio was betting big on the number two Porsche. But it wasn't the gamble it might have seemed. Ferdinand Ferry Porsche was born on September 19, 1909, and was involved in Porsche operations in its earliest days. In the early 1930s, Ferry joined Ferdinand's team as a test driver during the development of the first Volkswagen and helped design military vehicles and run factories alongside his father during the war with French slaves, I guess.
I also imagine being a test driver for a Volkswagen.
Yeah.
Nope, not slow enough. Not enough body roll.
Yeah. It's even widely believed that Ferry, not Ferdinand, had the biggest hand in designing the Schwimmwagen. Duccio was in experienced hands, and Ferry worked quite literally like his father's life depended on it. Around 9 months later, on August 1st, 1947, Ferdinand was released on bail after 15 months in prison. The actual amount Duccio paid was never officially disclosed, but most estimates are between 500,000 and 1 million francs, or between $1.6 and $3.2 million in today's money.
That's like some Roger Stone bail-ass money.
Yeah. Neither Ferdinand or Ferry were ever formally tried for war crimes based on a lack of evidence, but it's also possible that the Nazis like burned a lot of their records and everything. Yeah. I mean, they did that, but it's possible that you know, evidence of their corroboration or collaboration was destroyed. So that's a bummer. But Ferdinand was labeled as a collaborator and forced to undergo a process of denazification that was overseen by a French court. It's also worth noting that decades later, several former slave laborers from World War II factories managed by the Porsches came forward, and Porsche, the company, came clean to wrongdoing and has given millions of euros to the victims and their families. So,
okay.
So there you go. When Ferdinand returned to Austria, Ferry took him to the shop where he had been working on Duccio's state-of-the-art Grand Prix car. Ferdinand was beyond impressed with his son's work and told those close to him, quote, "I would have done it exactly the same as Ferry, right down to the last screw." It was fortunate for the company that Ferry was every bit as skilled as his father. By this point, Ferdinand was 72 years old, and his time in prison had accelerated his already declining health. Ferdinand had done everything he could to prepare his son for a career in engineering. Ferry had wanted to follow in his father's footsteps from the time he was a boy, but Ferdinand felt that since he constantly had to go above and beyond to prove himself thanks to his lack of a formal education, he made sure Ferry got one before joining him at the factory so that Ferry wouldn't have the same experiences. But Ferry had a different problem. In his early career, he was simply the boss's son and put in the extra work to be the best engineer he could possibly be. Without his father to lean on, Ferry had to design Duccio's Grand Prix car almost entirely on his own. It was the ultimate test to prove if he could carry the Porsche name when his father passed. And he crushed it. The final product, the Sissitalia Porsche Type 360, was way ahead of its time. Look at that, a silver German race car. Isn't that interesting?
Pill-shaped. Pill-shaped. Makes me want to eat pills.
You know? Makes me want to be a pillhead. It was the first mid-engine car ever designed for Grand Prix racing. It had selectable all-wheel drive, a double wishbone suspension, and was equipped with a first-of-its-kind 5-speed sequential transmission taken from a motorcycle. Unfortunately, the Type 360 was never given the opportunity to race. By the time development was complete in 1950, Formula One rules had been established, making its 360 horsepower, 1.5-liter twin supercharged flat 12 illegal.
This is kind of off subject, but that sucks. That
sucks. Yeah, yeah,
I'll
react
to that first, and then I'll go. that is a ton of work just to be like, nah, sorry.
Yeah,
but you could find a different racing series to put it in, right?
Maybe. I gotta hear this thing. A 1.5-liter
V12
twin supercharged flat 12.
Wow,
there's no videos of this thing, unfortunately.
That probably looks like a whale's spine, that engine, right?
Whoa, dude. You're so right, dude.
This is a little off subject, but
remember when they blew up that whale on that beach?
Dude,
okay,
that was like a war crime.
That was a long time ago. That was like, okay, when I was growing up, there was all those shows where it's like world's craziest videos or whatever, and like every episode it felt like they had to include
one
that
blown up
the blown up whale. I was like, at 7 years old, I was like, this is the only thing that's ever happened is that a whale blew up. And then 9/11 happened.
Oh my god, you had to go there. This is a little off subject.
Coincidence? Read the book.
The book.
That was an old, it was a Time Life books they would sell.
Commercial
and be like, oh, there was some conspiracy theorist talking to another guy at work, and then he'd be like, well, what happened? Read the book. And that was the whole thing. Coincidence?
This is a little off subject, but this is a new
12 miles away. A woman in her house spontaneously combusts.
Okay, never mind.
Coincidence?
What was it?
Read the book. Never mind.
No, I want to hear it.
No, you don't.
I do. I just wanted to say read the book again.
All right, this is a little off subject, but this is a new bespoke track car company called Shoreline Bespoke Vehicles.
Okay.
A little on the nose, but go ahead.
We're talking about like motorcycle engine or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They take
we're talking about the motorcycle
a BMW inline six from like touring bike. It's a 1.2-liter inline six. They put ITBs on it, and then they put this like tube frame chassis around it. It looks like have you seen this before?
This is sick. No,
it's
I've never
really
seen
cool.
This.
It's like 1,300 pounds, and it looks like an old Le Mans GT car.
Oh my god!
Yep. And the engine sounds amazing with these like ITBs on it. Super sick though.
Yeah, looks like a Ferrari.
Yeah, it's rear wheel drive.
It would be funny if it was front wheel drive. So anyway, it's got that the engine that's not legal. The whole thing's not legal for Formula One, but for Duccio anyway, the rule changes meant very little. He had gone bankrupt before the rule changes were even implemented. And sadly, Porsche didn't have enough of their own money to keep the over-engineered and finicky machine in perfect operating condition. And the 360 was resigned to nothing more than a what-if legacy.
Man, I gotta find a rich Italian dude just like bankrupt himself over my project.
What would your project be for this Italian?
Like edible overalls.
Okay.
Cause like you got edible underwear, right?
Yeah, I'm wearing them now. What if you, yeah, it's like survival. If you're in a pinch, what if your car breaks down?
You got some, you have to like peel Fruit Loops off your genitals to survive.
These are jerky flavored. Jerky.
Yeah, you know, like the market is flooded with sweet edible underwear.
Yeah.
Where's the savory edible underwear?
Yes. Yeah. On where's my like junk?
The fibrous, like, you know, you want a lot of fiber.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want, like,
you don't know when health
protein.
Coming.
Protein. Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me that hard tack.
That biltong. Biltong tighty whities.
Yeah, dude.
We'll be right back after these messages.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/Ohio's time.
Now back to the show.
Fortunately for automotive history, Duccio had paid the Porsches in full before this collapse happened, and Ferry hadn't put all of Porsche's eggs in the Duccio basket.
I also think of Duccio like, remember how I gave you all that money?
Yeah.
You don't have any of that left. You guys got military uniforms aren't as in high demand anymore.
Let me call Juventus, but
while developing the 360, Porsche simultaneously developed a road car under their own name, known as the Type 356. And to get the parts and the extra cash Porsche needed to build it,
they used French slave labor.
Ferry paid a visit to Volkswagen. Under British occupation, VW began producing the Type 60, or what later became known as the Beetle, for sale to the general public.
I've never heard of that, the Type 60.
I mean, as you might remember from our last episode, Ferdinand designed the Type 60 for Hitler's People's Car program, but the car never made it into full-scale production before the war began.
I think we talked about it in the VW episode, but there was like kind of a lottery or like a, you sign up,
right?
You earn these stamps and then you fill out, you put the stamps in your little book.
Yeah.
And then if you fill your book up with stamps, kind of like Scholastic,
yeah,
then you get to pick out a car, but it never really panned out.
No, because I don't know what. Yeah. Probably that. Ferry was out to stake a claim for his father's invention and presented his case in Germany. As we discussed in part one, Ferdinand borrowed heavily from Austrian manufacturer Tatra in the Beetle's design, but that didn't stop a German court from agreeing that the Porsches owned the rights to the Beetle. Ferry then worked out an agreement with VW in which Porsche would receive a license fee on every Beetle they built. It was maybe the most important decision Ferry could have made. In a few short years, the affordable Beetle became the most popular car in the cash-strapped post-war Europe, and Porsche had plenty of extra cash to spend.
So the Beetle bankrolled Porsche.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Ferry also struck a deal to use Volkswagen parts in the making of their sports cars after being inspired by Cisitalia's similar partnership with Fiat. Type 356 was very much a Volkswagen at heart. The body was designed around the Beetle's chassis, and it used a tuned and upgraded version of the Type 60's 1.1-liter flat four. It also borrowed heavily from the Type 60's aesthetic, including the long, curving body lines and circular headlights. And although Volkswagen abandoned that sort of design language decades ago, it's still used by Porsche to this day. The 356 is often credited as being the first true Porsche, as it was built on a platform that Porsche owned, was designed and assembled under the Porsche roof, and bore only the Porsche name. Although other cars bearing the name Porsche had existed before, they existed as collaborative efforts or were badged under another brand name entirely.
Going back to the headlights, I don't know how big of P-car heads you guys are.
I'm not.
The purists hate the 996, not only because it went from air cooled to water cooled, but also the headlights are
the fried egg, like the runny egg.
Yeah.
Runny egg, whatever.
I've seen a lot of 996s around recently. Mm-hmm. I think they're like getting.
I think like, they're snatched up because the purists don't appreciate them. And then somebody gets in them and they're like, holy shit, this is still a Porsche.
Yeah. I don't mind. Yeah. I don't even mind the fried egg headlights too. They're not that bad looking.
Agreed.
Agreed.
Agreed all around.
And that's been my purest minute.
The 356 may have not been an immediate sales success when it launched in 1948, but car enthusiasts loved it. The 356 also managed to score a class win at Innsbruck in Austria the year it debuted. Ferry worked on the car constantly to make improvements. By the early 1950s, there were several iterations, including the Speedster and the Carrera. In January of 1951, the moment Ferry had been dreading for years finally came to pass. Ferdinand died at age 75 from complications from a stroke he had barely 2 months prior. Ferdinand's automobile expertise was almost as old as the car itself. He was one of the most remarkable automotive engineers of his time and had pioneered automotive technology in ways that would have seemed like a fantasy in the early days of the car.
He was making like a flat six in the 19s or like the 20s or something that made 275 horsepower.
I mean, he made the hybrid, remember?
Yeah, hybrid. Crazy. Yeah, he was just like, and no formal education is crazy.
There is certainly a very dark chapter in Ferdinand's legacy, and yet no one could argue the impact he had on the auto industry. Though Ferry had been functionally running the company for years, he was truly the torchbearer now, and the weight of the already legendary Porsche name was on his shoulders. Yeah, like you said, Joe, very illustrious guy, if not a collaborator with the Nazis.
Name another 16-year-old that wired his parents' house with electricity. Huh? I'm waiting.
In the early 1950s, Porsche was reeling from the death of their founder, and Ferry was eager to carry on his father's legacy. Celebrities and car enthusiasts were catching on to the 356, but nothing could have done more for the brand or the car's image than what took place in June of 1951. Before his death, Ferdinand had met with Le Mans race director Charles Farrou during a trip to Paris, and convinced him to allow Porsche to enter the 356 in the legendary 24-hour race.
While they were discussing this over some pommes frites,
Charles said, hey, didn't you use some of my people as slaves?
Yeah.
Why are you still in Paris?
After he passed 5 months before the race, Ferry ensured Porsche had a car ready to race. And on June 24th, Porsche's lone entry scored a class win and finished 20th overall. Sales skyrocketed, and repeat wins at Le Mans and in other prestigious races across Europe, and with new and successful race cars like the 550 and the 718, made Porsche all but a household name. But by the mid-1950s, technology was moving fast. The cars of the late 40s and early 50s mostly used 1930s technology out of financial necessity, but as the world recovered from the war, things changed quickly. Porsche rival Mercedes dropped perhaps the world's first supercar, the 300 SL, in 1954. Cars like the Ferrari 250 and Jaguar E-Type pushed platforms even further in the late 50s and early 60s, and even the Chevy Corvette was encroaching on Porsche sales in the
and
important...
even the Chevy Cruze was inching up on...
even the Chevy Corvette was encroaching on Porsche sales in the important American market.
I want to do an episode just on the 300 SL because it... I think we've done the history of Mercedes.
Yeah, we did.
But like the 300 SL has so like it was in the huge crash in 1955 at Le Mans.
Yeah.
But also it won the Carrera Panamericana and a bunch of other races at the time. And it was like the car to beat.
We should talk about it. Porsche couldn't lean on a 10-year-old design based on 20-year-old technology anymore. Discerning customers had also grown wary of the sports car based on an increasingly popular economy car, and Porsche needed to make a change. Ferry led the charge and directed the engineering team to get to work designing a new flagship car with more power, but that retained the sharp handling of the 356. Ferry's son, Butzi, stepped up to the challenge. Ferdinand Alexander Butzi Porsche was born on December 11, 1935. When he was a kid, he would visit his father and grandfather at their factories. Butzi It's spelled B-U-T-Z-I.
Bootsy.
Bootsy. Bootsy loved cars and expressed later in life that he felt very fortunate to have been born in such a privileged position in the automotive world. Bootsy had taken the lead in the design of Porsche's successful 718 race car in the late 50s, and in the early 60s, he became the lead of the styling department.
How lucky for him that he grew up to like cars.
I know, right?
That would have sucked if he didn't.
Bootsy had a radical idea for Porsche's next flagship. He believed that Porsche shouldn't just make a better sports car, but a more practical one as well. A two-seater design might have been the standard, but it only served a narrow set of needs. He envisioned a two-and-two four-seater coupe that was reliable, had storage space, and great performance, and drew up a concept called the Type 754 T7.
Oh.
Ow.
That looks like another Porsche. I can't put my finger on it.
It was a natural evolution of the road cars that came before it, with round, pronounced headlights and swooping body lines. It also had Porsche's now iconic flat hood and the arched roofline that allowed for a usable back seat. Hanging over the rear wheels was a 130 horsepower, 2-liter, flat six that could get the car to 60 in around 8 seconds. Looking back now, it's easy to see it as an obvious move given the 911 success, but at the time, a four-seater sports car was practically unheard of. At first, Ferry hated it and was convinced it would alienate Porsche diehards. Even back then, they're worried about the purists, you know? But Bootsy was adamant that this was the way to go. And after several long back and forths, the concept was greenlit for production as the 901. The 901 debuted at the Frankfurt Motor Show in September of 1963 and entered production 13 months later.
I like how he's like, no, these two back seats are going to ruin our brand image. And they're like, not even big enough to hold a bowling ball.
Very shortly into its life, the car faced a problem. Following a 901 showcase in Paris, Peugeot sent a delegation to Porsche to inform them that they had the exclusive rights to sell cars in France with 3-digit names with a 0 in the middle.
Got him!
This meant that if Porsche wanted to sell the car in France, they couldn't call it 901. Only a handful of cars badged as 901s had even been produced at this point, and rather than make a change for the French market only, the name was changed to 911 for all markets.
Yeah, sorry, we gotta switch to this cooler name.
Oh shit, they figured it out.
We'll be right back after these messages.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/Ohio's time.
Now back to the show.
Car enthusiasts were blown away by the precision of the handling, its eager engine, and the fact that it could haul their family around when they weren't putting the car through its paces.
Yeah, if you got little bowling ball kids.
Bowling ball babies.
A lot of kids look like bowling balls. Mm-hmm. They're big heads.
Wyatt's got a huge head.
Got a big head.
Wyatt,
he'll
parents,
grow into it.
Yeah. Yeah. He's going to be 6'7".
Yeah, I think so. He's going to play for the Rockets.
My son will never play for the Rockets, all right? I'm not going down to Houston.
That's when my dad stopped talking to me. When I got drafted by the Rockets.
The car was also designed to be very reliable, a quality of 911s that stands to this day. In fact, over 70% of all 911s ever built are still on the road.
That's nuts.
That's unreal.
That's crazy.
I also heard that about Subarus, that like 90% of Subarus that were built are still in the
road. They got a crazy percentage.
Subaru backwards is you are a bus.
The 911 and its 27-year-old designer became icons overnight. And the 911 continued to get better in racing and road form.
My friend Phoebe has been on 2 episodes of that 911 show.
Uh-huh.
One time she was completely blue because she drank
colloidal silver.
Something like that. So she like completely covered in blue paint. The last one, she was the same character, but they had her like they accidentally mixed up the tubes at the dentist and they filled her mouth with like ether or like ethanol or something like that.
Okay.
And so she like breathed fire onto her dentist. Like flames were shooting out of her mouth.
That was like a great show.
Yeah.
You gotta tune in.
Like a fun character to keep coming back.
That is to give her and to be like, hey, let's get that blue gal again. You know, like good for her.
People really like that blue gal. Yeah. Get her back in and pump methanol into her mouth.
Is there a connection?
Well, 911. 911 is the show.
Oh, yeah.
911.
Like,
well, also, you met her husband.
I did?
Zakoyama is her husband. Yeah. Dell, you met her baby,
I met
too.
Del. I know Denim Dell. Dell Denim.
While we're talking about things that aren't cars,
I had
a roommate who had finished med school and he was doing his residency. And like his parents were like, oh, you should watch House. You'd like House. And so then it'd start and then be like, what's wrong with this person? And he'd always be like, oh, she's probably been to Brazil. It's a rare parasite. Click. But then like he'd always be right in the first 5 minutes.
What?
Yeah. Because like if you're a doctor.
Yeah.
You know these things. And but the show is not for doctors.
No, it's for idiots.
Like
for
idiots like us.
Yeah.
We're like, how are they going to figure this out?
Yeah.
Oh, it's probably lupus.
But if you're a doctor, it's like, oh, this is a thing where it could present as that, but I don't think it's that. If this person has diabetes, they're probably going to find out that it's this third. Like, they just, they're, anyway.
Wow.
Yeah, the show is bullshit, so.
Wow.
The show's bullshit. Sucks. No, it's great. You, Lori?
Your parents love it.
We watch it all the time.
Yeah. I know. Everybody's parents love House.
Yeah.
That's just how it is.
All right. So 9/11 and its 27-year-old designer became icons overnight. And the 9/11 continued to get better in both racing and road form. The first race the 9/11 ever entered was the 1965 Rally Monte Carlo, where it scored an impressive fifth place in a mostly unmodified trim. The racing division of Porsche, led by Ferrari's nephew, Ferdinand Piëch, learned fast and quickly became a force to be reckoned with. Piëch had an engineering degree and even did his final thesis on F1 engine design, something he was happy to translate to the 911. Thanks to Piëch, a 911 racing engine was developed that featured dual overhead cams, a dry sump oil pump, and a shorter stroke. And soon, the 911 and Porsche cars in general were winning in just about everything they entered. When they returned to the Monte Carlo rally in 1968, the 911 took the win and did so for the next 2 years. It was the same story just about everywhere else, with the 911 winning in everything from touring cars to hill climbs. 1968 alone was an insane year for the car, in which it won 41 championships and major prizes, including its victory at Monte Carlo and GT class wins at Le Mans and at the Targa Florio.
Man, I would love to drive one of these old Porsches.
You're pretty cool. Its skill set on the road was just as broad as its skill set for the track itself. The 911 today is known for its absurdly long list of variants and trim levels, and it all started in the 60s when Porsche realized that the 911 could be more than a practical everyday sports car, but every type of car between that and a race car. The first 911 variant was the S in 1966, which made 30 more horsepower over the original model and had larger brakes. It was an easy formula to follow. It had more power, better handling, and even more hardcore versions like the 911R followed. Porsche also took the car in a softer direction and began designing a convertible. But shortly into the process, news broke that one of Porsche's biggest markets, the United States, was considering banning convertibles outright in the name of safety. Just as they did when Peugeot forced them to stop using the name 901, Porsche decided it was best to take a universal approach to a problem and create a U.S. legal open roof car for all markets. What followed was the Targa. The name was taken from the legendary Targa Florio, and the model featured a removable roof panel over the front seats, but retained the rear portion of the roof, making it safer in case of a rollover. But in the end, the U.S. never passed the convertible ban, and a true convertible known as the Cabriolet was developed. But the Targa was such a success that Porsche kept it in its lineup.
It is a cool looking car.
I think it looks so
sick. And the fact that they were like, well, I guess we got to do this. I think it's a testament to how good of a design house Porsche had.
Very little has changed. And I think the best part of I love like spotting Targas because mm-hmm. that B pillar mm-hmm. has like the different colors, like so, silver.
It's like brushed aluminum or something.
It's so iconic. And yeah, it's just sick. Like, oh, I love seeing a Targa drive by.
They should make Targa top regular cab pickup trucks.
Cool.
That'd be yeah, sick.
That's cool.
Why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
We should make a video. Just do let's that to do your it. Truck.
That'd be sick. All it was right. done well. Let's
do it. Yeah. I mean, it won't be, but let's do it. I know if we're in 66, this is past the 550 Spider.
Mm-hmm. James Dean.
Yeah.
They had a race up in Salinas. They had a shop in, I think, Venice or somewhere. They needed to like tune the car on the way there. They needed to put some miles on the engine because it was a
James
fresh
Dean
engine.
Got the car and he would do races on the weekends. And he was such a commodity that the head of the studio was like, he did what? He's racing? Mm-hmm. Well, little bastard. You tell him he can't race. Oh, so then he named his car Little Bastard.
Because the head of the
studio called James Dean a Little Bastard.
That's pretty fun.
And he showed it to Alec Guinness. And Alec Guinness was like, oh, this thing is going to kill you.
Yeah.
Like he was like, over, and James Dean's like, whatever, old man. He's like, no, do not drive this. You'll be dead in a week.
Mm-hmm.
So they were going to tune it up on the way to the race, like to do a little shakeout. And then I forget his name, but he was coming the other way, I think in a Volkswagen. Maybe I'm wrong.
I thought it was like a truck.
I think it was a truck.
Was it a 55. Truck? Oh, he swerved to avoid the truck, but then he hit another dude.
Did he?
I don't know. Maybe look it up.
No, it was at a cross-section between two state highways.
Which is still there, by the way. It's still super sketchy.
Yeah.
41 and 46. It's like half an hour from the house I grew up in. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like the guy was going out to Fresno. He like turned in front of James Dean, the truck. Mm-hmm. James turns to the right to like dodge the truck.
Mm-hmm.
Car right, goes then somewhat into the ditch, but then the driver's side hits the truck. He's ejected from the vehicle. Oh, wait. No. He gets pinned in the vehicle. His passenger, though, his mechanic, this dude named Rolf, is ejected from the car. Rolf survives. Meanwhile, 15 minutes later, like the rest of his racing team, who had like a van and a flatbed trailer, they pull up to the scene of the accident because they were just going to tow they could have just towed the car and everything would have been fine.
They needed to break it in?
They needed to like put some miles on the engine, break in the engine or something like that. So they were like, yeah, let's just drive it up there. And they were going to stop, I think, in Paso Robles for the night or something. And
stop at Gilroy for the garlic.
Maybe they're going to drive all the way. I think they're going to stop for dinner in Paso, as the story goes. And
they're probably going to get some pasta.
Pasta?
They need carbs for the next day. It's a long drive.
Anyway, James Dean dies by the time he gets to the hospital. It was more of like, not really a hospital. It was like this medical center.
Triage.
At the airport. And he passes away. The drivetrain and stuff, mm-hmm. or the car gets like auctioned off. George Barris buys the chassis.
Barris buys it later
on.
It fell
after
off.
After, because it's cursed. So what happens is there's a doctor buys the car, and they take the engine and the drivetrain. So the car that received its engine also killed its driver.
No, that was the transmission.
Oh, there's a transmission.
But also they don't. So I've done a lot of research on this pretty recently.
Please.
So the engine went into a Lotus race car. That doctor guy, he gets in like a collision on track, and that's part of this curse, right?
Yeah.
He just got in a collision. It was fine. And then his buddy bought the transmission for the car. Okay. He also bought it for another Lotus race car that they like race together. But the first doctor guy who bought the engine is like, I'm not sure if he was actually running the transmission that day when he crashed and died. It was also like the 60s. So yeah, like everybody, if you crashed in a race car, you're going to probably die. Later on, like you said.
Before all this, when they were loading it on the flatbed,
it
slipped and it broke the guy's hip.
Yeah. When they were loading
the truck driver's hip.
Yeah. So that's another meme.
And then, George Barris buys. I think all this comes from George Barris because George Barris buys the car and he takes it on like a tour. It was like a highway safety, like,
Roadshow,
like exhibit thing. I think he was George Barris. He's a showman. He's an entertainer. Like he's marketing genius kind of guy. I think he made a lot of this up.
Well, and then it disappeared.
Yeah. Then the car it still has not been found. The 550.
Yeah.
And then the transaxle, the transmission sold like last year for like $400,000.
Right.
Which I think is like kind of cool actually that someone has it. But
and I think it's bullshit. That guy used it to bludgeon someone to death. So it's just incredibly cursed.
It's very sad, obviously, that James Dean passed away that way. But I think, like, the curse nature of it, a lot of the other details besides, like, the broken hip thing, there's, like, another one where it supposedly killed somebody. Like, there's all these deaths linked to it.
Like, there was something to, like... Also, someone used the tires.
Yes.
And they blew.
It's like, okay, but why would you use tires from a wrecked car? Like, they're an expendable item. That's bullshit. That's totally bullshit. That's right. That gives away the game for me. It's like, who would use tires from that wreck?
Yeah.
Get out of here. Yeah.
Get out of here.
Get out of here.
Go to Gilroy. Go eat some garlic.
Get back to Gilroy. Okay.
I did see the most garlic I've ever seen in my life.
In Gilroy?
It was on the way to Vegas.
I don't have any vampires in Gilroy.
It's just like, it was the truck, but then two beds full of garlic.
Was it falling off the truck?
No, that shit's like gold, dude.
They would never let that happen. They would never let the window catching all the garlic stuff.
But it was like, but it was also, you know, it was open. Like there was grates on either side because you got to keep that garlic from getting sweaty.
Yeah. Sweaty garlic is not good garlic, let me tell you.
Does the produce at the bottom of those trucks get just, like, totally crushed?
No.
With all the weight? Like, that's like a ton of garlic on top of the garlics at the bottom.
Baby garlic?
Yeah.
I think that garlic at the bottom just gets hardened. That's the kind of stuff that you bite into and it just...
Garlic diamonds. Okay, sorry. Let's wait.
Bottom garlic. Give me that bottom garlic. You gotta dig deep to get them.
From under garlic.
The From Under garlic. Kind of stinky. All right. All right. So by 1970, the Porsche name was synonymous with performance, reliability, and success on the racetrack. No longer was it chasing the supercars from Jaguar to Mercedes. Now they were chasing Porsche. The company now had its facilities, cash flow, and expertise to fund even higher levels of racing. They'd taken class wins at Le Mans, but now they wanted to win it all. But Porsche's competition was catching up. In the late 60s, an arms race between Ferrari and Ford was on, and either a Ford or Ferrari had taken first place at Le Mans every single year throughout the decade. It was the most competitive environment Porsche could enter. Ferdinand Piëch led the development starting in 1968, and after barely 10 months, Porsche had a Le Mans contender. In 1970, the car was put to the test. Their car was the 917K. Yeah, dude.
One of the sickest liveries.
If you've seen, was it Le Mans with Steve McQueen?
Mm-hmm.
You've seen this car. In Le Mans trim, the 917K had a 4.9 liter flat 12, making 600 horsepower. It weighed only 1,763 pounds and could hit speeds nearly 200 miles per hour down the Mulsanne Straight. The team only had two drivers. You had Hans Hermann and Richard Atwood. One advantage to having fewer drivers is pitting fewer times than your rivals to change drivers. But thanks to inconsistent and rainy weather, their advantage was all but erased thanks to frequent tire changes. In the end, the team overcame these issues and pulled out Porsche's first Le Mans victory. Today, Porsche is one of the most successful manufacturers to ever run the race, winning a total of 19 times.
Damn.
That's crazy. Dude, this thing is one of the sickest looking race cars ever.
You know what really made sense to me is, like, gravity. Toyota is a very safe company. You know, like, they don't make a lot of fast cars. Supra is, like, the outlier. Why Toyota decided to start doing Le Mans and prototype racing, you know?
I mean, that technology does trickle down.
Yeah. Probably the hybrid system more than anything.
Yeah. I think that's probably why.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that was short.
That's an answer. There you go. Glad we talked about it.
I'm so glad we talked about this, guys.
Just as quickly as Porsche had arrived at the pinnacle of motorsport and sports car manufacturing, a huge change was about to take place. In 1972, at age 63, Ferry decided it was time to step down. The company was bigger now than Ferdinand or Ferry might have ever hoped for. Far from contract work or bespoke race car building, Porsche was a true manufacturer in its own right, and arguably had the best motorsport team in the world. It was more than Ferry saw himself equipped to handle, and to ensure the survival and success of the company, a restructuring of management began. Ferry wanted to get the family out of leadership entirely. In his mind, they were engineers, not CEOs. Ferry became chairman and Butzi and Pich retained their design and engineering roles, but were no longer given the authority to make decisions for the company. How did Porsche continue and even build upon the success started by the family? How did they refine and modernize the 911 while holding fast to tradition? How did they revolutionize the car industry with hypercars? And why did they start making SUVs? We're going to find out on the finale of Past Gas's Porsche series next week. That's our story for this week. Part 3 of 3 coming soon, guys. Stick around for that. Follow Bart at BidsBardo. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. And thank you to our crew, Audrey and Edgar, behind the camera there.
Audrey also wrote this episode.
Audrey did write this one. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.